On the tables, there are people that have been to the Holy Land. Will they make themselves known by waving their hands in the air? Yep. Doesn't matter when you went, you didn't have to go last year, as long as you've been there. Because you have just volunteered to speak to all of those people that aren't waving their hands and to make yourself available to answer their questions so that you can tell them what it was really like. So what I'd like to do now to get the first speaker underway is to hand you over to Leslie. Leslie's the Christchurch administrator, so everybody is supposed to know Leslie. And she will talk to you about it, and I'll introduce the other speakers as we go.
Well, welcome and good morning again. Thank you, Bruce, for your introduction. It's a great day, and it was a wonderful morning that dawned when we were all out there in our car park waiting for the coach to come and pick us up. Our bags were eventually packed, even mine, and we had an equally packed itinerary in our pockets. But did we really know what to expect? Were we all going to have exactly the same experience? Well, you might think so, because we were all travelling together and we're going to the same place, but I think not necessarily so, because some things obviously naturally just appeal to one person more than another. So although collectively we experienced a great number of things together, some things just touched and impacted individuals, perhaps a little bit more so than others. For me, it was not so much visiting the buildings, which may or may not have accurately marked the places where Jesus was born and lived and died, but the fact that we were actually in Jesus' homeland. You need to give yourself a little pinch occasionally while you're there. And for me, it wasn't so much about seeing the landscapes and walking on the land, or even on the beaches. In some cases, we actually swam in the Sea of Galilee, and we definitely all sailed across it together. But it was experiencing the actual sights and the sounds and the smells, even the heat of that midday sun, all those eternal things that Jesus knew when he lived on this earth. Fully human, where he lived his daily life, which actually, for the early years, we know so very little about. Growing up with his parents, then working, teaching, and ultimately dying an incredibly cruel death on the cross to save us all. So those are the sort of things that tend to do it for me. The first 3 days in Galilee were absolutely fantastic. But I have to say, the first one was quite punishing. Ibrahim, who was our other guide besides Stephen, was in information overload. You know, it was coming at us all directions, and we hopped on and off of that coach so many times, I'm sure I had repetitive strain injury by the end of the day. And I'm just looking at the other fellow pilgrims who were with us that day, and I think they can all empathise, but it did calm down a bit after that. Oh dear. So our guide Ibrahim, just quickly to say, he was such a lovely man. He took to calling us all, what, ladies and gentlemen? Hababini, his darlings. Yalla was the response to that. Well, anyway, after being in that area for those 3 days, we travelled on to Jerusalem, and we arrived actually quite late in the day. It was just time to unpack, have yet another lovely meal. And then, actually, I was one of the people that chose to go with Stephen on his little informal night tour into the old city just to have a coffee with the locals. That was pretty special, actually. Anyway, the next morning, obviously, the coach came to pick us up. And we were going to go on for a full day, our first full day of a walking tour in Jerusalem, the old city itself. And we were going to start off with the Mount of Olives. So we went first to the Chapel of Ascension right at the top, and then started our walk progressing slowly down the mount itself. Well, we had actually only been walking for quite a few minutes along typically small road with a low wall coming up on the right-hand side. And that was when you just turned and got your first view of the old city of Jerusalem. Wow. A picture is pretty darn good, but let me assure you, the reality is absolutely fantastic. Even as we stood there watching, the sun just moved across and illuminated the golden dome of the rock. And it really is an absolutely mesmerizing sight. Well, from there, we walked on down to the upper levels of an enormous Jewish cemetery. You think that's a pretty funny place to stop and look, but actually, it's a very auspicious place for the very religious Jews. They hope, by being buried there, to be among the first to follow the Messiah on the day of redemption, if he really does come back and enter the temple courts through what is actually currently blocked, the Golden Gate. Who knows? But having paused to take a look at the sites and have them explained, we went on a little bit further and came to the most absolutely beautiful spot overlooking the old city. And it's marked with a very simple teardrop-shaped little chapel called Dominus Flavit. And this just marks the place where Jesus wept as he predicted the destruction of the city itself, knowing that not one stone shall be left on another. And of course it wasn't. But as we sat and listened to that scripture again, you know, as we've all heard these things lots of time, but reading each of these scriptures in the actual sites where they were pertinent to, was a very special privilege. I won't ever forget doing my reading. But there in that place where Jesus wept, we found I wept too. It was just such a poignant moment and such a special thing just to one individual. But I bet it was special to an awful lot of other people as well. From there, walked down slowly to the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, it's incredibly ancient olive trees, and it's got a particularly beautiful, sort of faintly haunting atmosphere. The pain and torment, obviously, that Jesus suffered there is quite unspeakable. Well, for me, going then into the Church of All Nations, which is a beautiful, beautiful church, don't get me wrong, and again, it's built, as so many of these other churches are, on former church sites, whether they be Byzantine or Crusader. But they're thronged with visitors half the time. And for me, I found a lot of those sort of very big churches and buildings a little bit overpowering. I actually was really, personally, I think, better off out in the open, walking through the streets of Old Jerusalem, the Via Dolorosa, which are the stations of the cross, where you walk through all these little, narrow, almost impossibly crowded little streets, where it's not unusual, actually, to pass some arms-bearing Israeli soldiers who are supposed to be there for our protection. Well, I'm sure they were. And soaking up the atmosphere at the end of that day where we were on the Mount of Olives, right down in the garden tomb at the end of that day, was a very, very special moment again. There are just a couple of things that I wanted to share with you that really, really touched me. I found that day a very emotional journey. And on a separate occasion, a couple of days later, because we had to ring the changes, we all see from the itinerary that is there, we were going on another walking tour, this time more over to the other side of Jerusalem, and through the Jewish quarter. And we were on our way to see lots of different sites, but one of them, obviously, you end up in the huge great square where you've got the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, which is divided up, so men go one side, ladies go the other. Men have got bar mitzvahs and things going on that day, but we were all peering over the top of the fences and things, trying to get our photos and see what was going on. Well, I didn't really ever actually plan to go right up to the wall where there were lots of people praying and things, but I felt strangely drawn to it, you know. And eventually I did go there, and I did put my hands on that warm, smooth rock. And again, I was just hit by the fact that there's been so many countless generations doing that very thing there in that same place. And it was a special moment. And by then we were very aware of the sadness of the political situation in that land. And for me, it helped so much to just be able to stand there and pray for peace and reconciliation, if for no other reason than to combat my own feelings of rather helpless despair. So that was another pretty emotional moment. And you might think, was it all gloom and doom? Not at all. We laughed as much as we ever cried, laughed more, I'd say. And we experienced just wonderful fellowship and made lots of great new friends. People we thought we knew, you get to know so much better. We ate so well. We slept like babies at the end of days where we were exhausted with all the activities. None of us got ill. None of us got lost or injured or had anything stolen. Well, that's pretty special too. And Stephen managed to bring us all home safely. And we can now truly share with him some of that passion he has for this most special of lands and its numerous problems. So, having walked where Jesus walked, am I glad? Having been so moved, am I glad? Having shared these experiences with my fellow pilgrims, am I glad? And now having more in common with them than ever before, am I glad? Having learned about the political situation, am I glad? Hey, most certainly so. And all I can really say to you is, if you've never been there before, you really must take any opportunity you have to go for yourself. We and our fellow, we can tell you about it until we're almost blue in the face. But nothing, nothing can take the place of experiencing the Holy Land for yourself. It is an enormous privilege and a terrific blessing. So I do encourage you to think about it for yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leslie. The person that's going to speak next is Richard, and he's been a member of Christ Church, as everybody knows, since Moses was a lad. And Richard is an accountant. His degree is in history, so he is a very serious-minded fellow. We say sir to him because he also leads the team that does the account audits for Christ Church, so he knows where the bodies are buried. Richard, come and give us another perspective on it. Thank you.
Hello. I find it quite difficult to follow Leslie's presentation. That was absolutely excellent. I'm sure you'll agree. Yes, well, when Bruce told me I was doing this, I mean, it's as you know, Christ Church runs on the democratic principle of one man, one vote, and the one man with the one vote is Bruce. So here I am. I will be talking through some photos just to give an illustration of what I'm saying. Right. This was my first ever trip to Israel. Obviously, I'd been brought up in a Christian home, nearly 50 years at that stage. Never been there, had no real idea what it was like. So I wasn't quite certain what to expect, really. In some ways, it was exciting. In other kinds of ways, it was daunting. Would it live up to my expectations? Would I be excited? Would I be disappointed? How would I react to it? Was one of the things I was thinking before I went there. My experience was that it was not quite in the wave as I was expecting it to be, but it certainly made a very powerful impression. And since coming back from that, I've sort of greedily devoured any information I can on Israel and the Holy Land. Certainly going there will increase your experience, really, and your knowledge. And it will illuminate so many things. Anyway, the first thing I would say, it would certainly change your perspective when reading the Bible. Instead of just reading sort of black and white on a piece of paper, you will be able to visualize it in your mind's eye. There's no quiet experience like saying, I've been there, I know what it feels like, I know what the countryside looks like, I know what the distances and things like that. I mean, the first pleasant surprise was the Sea of Galilee, which, as you can see, is absolutely beautiful, or at least it is when it's not having a storm. But the kind of mild temperature and the beautiful, beautiful scenery was just very special. That's the wrong way. And that's just to prove I was there. We also went to Capernaum. We went to Nazareth. We went to Caesarea Philippi. I now know what the wilderness between Jericho and Jerusalem looks like. I now know what a sycamore tree in Jericho looks like. A tree that is so important, but it merits its own road sign. I now know what the city of Jerusalem looks like. And as Leslie told us, the view is absolutely stunning. The kind of the hills and the sky and everything and the stone is just such a beautiful view. It is just... And when you go in, you see the crowded streets. And it'll take you back to first century Jerusalem. The city has been destroyed and rebuilt so many times, but within the walls and everything, it will give you a very good idea of what first century Jerusalem would have been like. You go to the Garden of Gethsemane. You see some steps going up to where we think the palace of the high priest was. You go to a place which may or may not have been Calvary, depending on which view you take. But it will give you a better idea than the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and places, which probably are more historically authentic. But because there is so much going on there, it is very difficult to actually concentrate on what's happening. And likewise, the Garden Tomb will give you a better idea of what it would have been like in the first century than the current crowded surroundings. The other thing, as Bruce says, I've got a history degree, I love history and anything to do with it. And I'll tell you, there is more history in Jerusalem and the Holy Land than there is anywhere else I've ever been. So if you were even moderately interested in history in the past, I would warmly recommend Israel as a suitable place to go and visit. As I say, it's been destroyed so many times and thought over more savagely than anywhere else on Earth, as far as I'm aware. And we did joke that all we could see of the past were cisterns. So we've got King Ahab's cistern. We've got King Herod's cistern. We've got Emperor Hadrian's cistern. And someone else's cistern. But there were more than cisterns. In fact, if you know where to look, there are so many things which will bring the history in the past and the biblical period as well vividly to life. I mean, you go right back to the Canaanite period. This is a Canaanite shrine buried deep below the ruins of Megiddo. And right up to the current day, civilizations have come and gone and left their mark. As I say, there are places that take you right back into the past, and these are the ruins of Megiddo. And these are the stables of King Solomon or King Ahab or King Jeroboam. No one knows quite which ancient Israelite king built it. But to go back there and see stuff the ancient Israelite kings built. This is before the Romans, this is before the Persians, it's before the Greeks, it's before the Babylonians, it's before the Assyrians. This is so old, and you almost don't believe it when you read it in the Bible, and then suddenly it comes to life. You're looking at it, it's real. I think the horse could probably do with a couple of bags of oats, mind you, but seeing that was just an amazing experience. And likewise, going to Masada. And you will see the outline of a Roman camp there. And you will see the siege ramp that was built to capture the place. And again, that just shows you the site and the view from the top. And again, history has brought so much to life. You don't expect to see these things, and you suddenly this isn't just a story. This is real all of a sudden. And moving forward in time, you can see Caesarea, and you can see the remains of Herod's aqueduct and his swimming pool as well. You go to Bethlehem and you can see an ancient Byzantine basilica with the mosaics. You can see remains of the crusading period. That's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and St. Anne's Church, which is absolutely beautiful. And over everything, of course, is that most charismatic of buildings, the Dome of the Rock, which stands out over everything in Jerusalem. The other thing which it brought to life was an appreciation of the present. And I expect, like many people, you read so many bad things about Israel and Palestine and the people who live there in the press. You hear of rocket attacks and heavy-handed responses and strife and aggravation. And that, I must admit, before I went, I had a sort of slightly negative view of what was going on there. And I think one of the other powerful things that the trip did for me, it helped me to get an understanding and a sympathy for both sides in that conflict. Just by being there and seeing how they lived, rather than sort of sitting in judgment on them, actually understanding much more of what their lives were like. So this is a very joyous scene. This is a bar mitzvah in the Jewish quarter of the Old City. And we went up to the Western Wall, which... and again, you could just wander up there. There was no test of making certain that you were religiously orthodox or anything. It was just open to absolutely everyone, as long as you had the appropriate headwear, of course. And that was a very moving experience, because understanding a culture and getting to sort of have sympathy for the people. And likewise on the Palestinian side. In this country, I think people are slightly worried about Muslim headscarves and things and Muslim culture. But in the old city of Jerusalem, it just felt absolutely natural. Everyone was wandering along. Everyone was going about their own business without any trouble. And in fact, I would say the Palestinians, without fault, were uniformly courteous, welcoming, and very hospitable. There was one incident where we were pulled up in a little Palestinian village outside Bethlehem. There was only one functioning loo, so 40 Westerners duly sort of queued up for that. I think that was probably a logistical mistake myself, but anyway, far from being fazed, the Palestinian people, the ladies brought out little cups of Turkish coffee for us, which was very nice, as we queued interminably. But there are other things that you see there which aren't quite so as agreeable to see. And this can be a little bit disconcerting. I think it's something you've got to do to understand what's happening in Israel and Palestine at the moment, but you become very quickly aware that this is a divided country between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And the wall, of course, is the great emblem of this division. And you know that either side hardly ever speaks to each other, unless they have to. They certainly don't understand each other. They certainly don't sympathise with each other. And this can be quite, again, it is quite affecting when you see that and you understand the bitterness that's there, and you can see the way in which people live. I mean, this is a Palestinian refugee camp, and the reason is because this is the only thing they've got from their old homes, which they were forced to flee when the state of Israel was created back in 47, and the Jewish people moved into the Jewish areas, and the Palestinian people moved into the Arab areas. The key is the symbol of this is what we've lost, this is what we hope to go back to, but this is the context in which things happen. We also saw the settlements that were springing up around towns like Bethlehem. On all the hilltops, you'll see highlighted in the sun, you'll see the sort of settlement which has gone up in recent years, surrounding the Palestinian village in the valley. We also see signs of stress and conflict within the holy city of Jerusalem itself. I mean, this menorah here looks very nice as a kind of tourist attraction until you realise that the intention is for that to move up the hill and go in a new temple built where the Dome of Rock is. But enough of the serious stuff. I found it was a great experience, even on a holiday basis. You were with friends, you had marvellous food, you saw marvellous sights, and the whole thing was just a sort of lovely experience. And our mascot, of course. And these magnificent churches, which, as Leslie said, they're perhaps, particularly the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Church of Nativity, they're quite difficult to actually relate to on a spiritual level, I have to say, because there was just so much going on there, it was just so chaotic. Some of the smaller churches, this is the Shepherd's Fields in near Bethlehem, absolutely beautiful. And that's the site of the Sermon of the Mount. And that's in Nazareth. And that's in Jerusalem, which is the Russian Orthodox. And I think that's Bethlehem, the Church of Nativity again. And even the good old Anglican Church, which looks like it came from Evesham or Pershore or somewhere like that. And as I say, marvellous food, from the ridiculous to the sublime. Well, thank you very much for listening to me. That's just my experiences of travelling to the Holy Land.
Thank you very much, Richard. We've had the administrator, we'd have the accountant-driven historian, and Arlene is going to talk to us next, and she comes from a consultancy background, and you are to notice that she is a lady, because in the end, we have to get this balance. Arlene.
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, so really I'd probably just like to explain my reasons for actually doing the pilgrimage, because for me that was one of the real tests of being a Christian in that respect. And then I'll reflect on my personal reflections during the trip and what it meant to me going with Christchurch and the things that I took from the actual experience. And then my thoughts on returning and I suppose the way it's impacted me and the way I suppose, change my point of view. So, my reasons for going. Well, originally, I think Christchurch offered the opportunity to go to the Holy Land in 2009. And I missed my opportunity to actually be part of that group. And although the trip was later rescheduled, I also go to a church in Birmingham. And they, likewise, were organising a trip to the Holy Land in 2009. And, likewise, I failed to get myself organised. But my parents did go in 2009, and when my mother came back, she just said it was just fantastic. She just said to actually see Jerusalem when she'd read the Bible as a little girl, not realising that actually these are places that she could experience. She said it was something that I really needed to consider and actually visit. And I have to confess, up until then, going to Jerusalem was just not in my consciousness. It was not something I'd even considered. But listening to my mum, I suddenly thought, actually, it's something I need to do. So when the opportunity came up in 2010 and Christchurch said they were going to be organising another trip, I just thought, you've got to go. Put your name down. just do it, and I joined the list. Now, having made that commitment, I suddenly realised, well, I really wanted to understand a bit more about the political, social issues that were going on in Israel and Palestine. I'd learnt about Judaism when I was young. I'd learnt about the Jews and what happened in the Second World War, and I'd had a certain amount of empathy with them, and I understood about the kibbutz and what they were trying to do. And I found myself in a situation that when I'd go out to dinner with friends and, you know, we'd talk politics and they'd talk about the Israeli atrocities and they'd say about the Americans what they were doing. And I just thought I was with radical people. I just thought, you know, what are your sources? This really cannot be the situation. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to be going to Israel, I really have the opportunity to learn firsthand. And really, my intention was to come back with some arguments so I can out-argue my friends. I'd have some evidence to actually counterbalance what they were telling me. So that was one of my motivations. Once I decided that I was actually going to make the trip, I realised I needed to learn more. Now, I was also fortunate around that time that I joined a house group with Jim and Heather Anderson. And, you know, I was speaking to Jim saying, look, you know, I'm going to be going to Jerusalem. I'd like to understand a bit more about what's going on. And Jim suggested I get a book from Jimmy Carter, which was about Palestine, peace, not apartheid. And he said, well, just read the book and decide for yourself what you think are the facts and what's going on. And, I mean, he was excellent because he was a voice of reason. He wasn't trying to persuade me. He was just giving me material that I could make a determination for myself. And that's something that really helped me before I actually got on the coach, left Christchurch, and was on the journey. I had lots of questions that I suddenly realised I needed to know more. And I've got to confess, yes, I've got Richard up there, and as Bruce said, you know, everyone knows Richard. And I joined Christchurch in 1990, and Richard was one of the first persons I met. But in those 20 years, I hadn't really made any inroads in the church family. I'd always kept on the periphery. And so by going to the pilgrimage, I knew that for me it was going to be a personal challenge because I'd have to get to know my fellow Christians. Daunting as it seemed, I realised that it was a challenge that I needed to make, and it was something that I was going to have to do and obviously enjoy, but I was going to be putting myself out there, both as a Christian and as an individual. So I went. I was looking for the arguments to out-argue my friends, and I've got to say the impact was just fantastic. I think, you know, as Richard's demonstrated and Leslie, the buildings, the religious monuments, what you see when you go out there and experience as a Christian is just beyond words. My mum was completely correct in the fact that she said it was just something you have to experience. And, you know, as Richard says, when you're in Galilee and you see the area, you see the calmness of the sea, it makes that reading so much more meaningful. And for me, it helped me understand some of Jesus' early teachings and possibly the way he expressed things. And, you know, yes, there's Robin who was in the Dead Sea, and we did have some fun times. We did have some moments where you could actually relax and get to see Israeli culture and see the nightlife and how the Israelis lived. And that, I think, is quite an interesting experience because it's just like being in London. You know, you suddenly realise they've got all the social trappings that we have here. And it is quite a nice lifestyle. And that itself, for me, was quite enlightening. But yes, it's a different cultural experience. You know, you've got the headscarf, you've got the food, you've got the smells. You do realise you are actually in the Middle East. And that itself is delightful once you get over the initial, oh my God, you know, what's going on? It's something that you suddenly begin to appreciate and realise that Jesus was a Palestinian. This is how he lived. This is his normal customs. And that's something that, for me, just reinforced the fact that the early Christians were from this area. And that was something I felt I had to take on board and trying to understand in the message that he was communicating. So, absolutely fantastic. Definitely brilliant. And definitely, I think, as a Christian, it's something, if you have the opportunity to experience, would recommend. The other thing I would probably suggest, and the reason for me why I decided to go with Christchurch rather than any other group, and obviously McCaid, is the fact that it's the people that you met on the trip. For me, they really made a difference to my experience. And because of Stephen, and I think because of the relationship that the church has, I knew that the people I would meet would be thought-provoking, they'd be challenging, they'd be passionate. and they'd give me an insight into an area that I don't think I would experience with any other church group. And I do believe, although, you know, it was challenging because it was very demanding. Physically, it was long days. Physically, you were meeting with people who had a lot to share, and they were open to have discussions. So you really were very challenged. And as Leslie said, Imran, who was our leader, it was interesting to see the amount of knowledge and the passion he had as a Christian and as a Palestinian Christian. That itself was just quite refreshing to actually realise, well, yeah, they're not all Muslims, you know. There are Christians out there, and that's a kindred and a spirit that we need to build upon and to recognise. And you also read and learned from the actual people who are dealing with some of the political and social issues of the area. And, you know, I've got absolute admiration for the fact that in such diversity that they can still have a sense of hope and a passion for the fact that they believe that change is possible, and they're using whatever means are available to try and let people understand what it is actually like to live in Palestine, to be the other side of the wall, and what their daily life is like. And so for me, I mean, I think as Richard highlighted, it was devastating. I mean, I'd come from the view where, you know, my friends, they were all radicals. Their sources and what they were telling me was completely not real. And I've got to confess, I'm like a converted non-smoker. Actually being there and being in the refugee camps, seeing the settlements around you, being behind the wall, I've got to say, for me, was the most emotional experience I've probably ever had in my life. To actually understand how I could live in an environment where my behaviour was monitored, I was controlled. Wherever I went, there was a security camera monitoring me. And I've got to confess, for me, I found that difficult to come to terms with. And I know as a Christian, it's supposed to be very peace-loving, but I think I would have difficulty living under such constraints and still being very loving in my treatment to the neighbour. As a Christian, it challenged me. When I saw the demolitions and I realised the impact it must have on their social well-being, how the children can go to school and what their social environment must be like, I really felt that it's something that I have to take a standpoint on. I couldn't come back and not be vocal with regard to what I saw and what I experienced. And so for me, I would definitely say a pilgrimage with Christchurch and Mackay will be thought-provoking. As Richard said, we may not go there with questions or with answers, but I think the experience that you have when you're there will certainly make you think. It was challenging from a physical viewpoint because it was long days, it was arduous, but certainly what you were being told and what you were being shared with, if you want to know more, the opportunity's there. If you choose not to, that's fine as well. But I think as a Christian, it will make you think and question. And that's something that obviously we all have to deal with as individuals. So coming back, really, for me, my thoughts are really a sense of hope, a sense of really trying to understand where I think there's an opportunity for trying to overcome some of the natural barriers that there are there. And one of the reasons I suppose I'm praying for and hoping is that we can actually get the children from the Israelis and the Palestinian side to start working together, just doing normal things, and to realise that it's not differences that separate them, and it's not differences that should lead to a sense of fear, but actually realising that we're all the same at the end of the day. I mean, I grew up in Birmingham, you know, back in the 60s, multicultural. It's very cheek by jowl with regard to your neighbours, and I've got to say that for me was one of the best things that ever occurred, because you grew up with people, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, every religion, and you suddenly realise that you've got so much in common. And I just hope that we can get to a situation where the children at least can start playing with each other and at least start realising that there is not so much to fear from the unknown. But like I said, I mean, I think we are a long way from that, but at the end of the day, that's something I think I can sort of work towards and try and help in a practical sense. And so for me, my real lasting thoughts are twofold. From a Christian and a religious perspective, when you see the landscape, I think I understand a bit more about Jesus' ministry. I understand the importance of Galilee, of Capernaum, of working with the disciples and growing in his faith. And I think I understand how he might have felt when he actually came into Jerusalem with the politics, the intensity of the culture, the oppressive feel of that city, and how he must have felt as a human. Because I certainly know that when we did the journey from Tiberian and walking into Jerusalem, it was just like, oh my God, you know, what have we come to? It was just so different to anything we'd experienced of the countryside. And for me, it helped me understand a bit more, I think, of how Jesus had to be so, I suppose, violent in his mission towards the end of his life, because he was dealing with people that were very set in their ways, and I suppose from his perspective, were heathens, and so the message had to be very hard-hitting. But also, it saddened me, because in the holiest of places, you had the Jews, the Muslims with their mosques, there was Christians there, you just realise there's still such injustice and oppression. And I feel, well, you know, this is how the early Christians must have felt, where they feel that they've got to speak up for those who are oppressed. Because, you know, Jesus taught us that we had to live in harmony. He died so that we could live in harmony. Yet you go to Jerusalem and I feel that we are still such a long way from that. And it just makes me realise that as a Christian, I have to look to what the early Christians did with regard to trying to spread the message, because we are still so far away from, I think, what he tried to achieve with his death. And yes, we can look at the world, we can look at Virginia Waters, I can look at Birmingham, but for me, it really hit me when I was in Jerusalem and you saw such tensions being fought in the name of religion. And that for me is where we think, well, you know, we've got to spread the word of God, and it's a case of trying to get some harmony and love amongst the differences. So those are my reflections, and I would definitely urge you to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arlene. So we've had Christian administrator, Christian historian, a Christian consultant, and our last speaker is Ken Edwards, and he has quite a long relationship with Israel and Egypt in his professional life in delivering airborne munitions accurately to the right place. He will explain what that means. But the reason why we've asked him to speak is that the three speakers so far have talked about going on a pilgrimage that this church has organised, but Ken went on a pilgrimage that he organised for himself and Angela, and therefore that's another dimension that you can ask questions on. Ken, please come and join us. Thank you.
If I was going to talk on my own and the other three hadn't been talking, I wouldn't have put things the way that I'm going to. So I'm going to maybe look at things from a slightly different perspective than the other three folk have done. It's been my privilege throughout my working career to have made a few hundred trips abroad, and some of those were to Israel. I first went there not for work, actually, about 35 years ago, and that was on a tour a bit like the folks went on last year. I went on, it was a coach trip with a group of people, and very much enjoyed that. And I've worked there, and I went there with my wife Angela two or three years ago, just the two of us, for 5 or 6 days. When I've gone to places for my work, I've either gone on my own or with two or three other fellas, usually, and I've been able to walk around on my own, drive around, and see things a little bit differently than you would if you were on a coach party, sort of trying to do as much as you can in a country in one go. So I guess looking back, I've learned to walk around with my ears open and my eyes open and just see and hear interesting things. So These are my own personal memories and observations. I could have put lots more in, like the ones that you've just heard, but these might be a little bit different. For me, it's a land of contrasts, Israel is. I would thoroughly recommend going. Of all the countries I've been to, this is the most interesting. I can recall when I was there first time and my first drive out, seeing a large Bedouin tent in the desert, which is, you know, nothing like culturally you would see here. And there, outside the Bedouin tent, was an antenna for picking up television programs, satellite TV. A land of contrast. So that's my feeling for what the place is like. Weather-wise, a contrast, you'll find it very hot in the desert and down by the Dead Sea, and I'll mention the Dead Sea later. If you go up to the north into the Golan Heights, you'll find it a lot cooler. And I can recall on my first trip there on my tour with other Christians, sitting on the top of a hotel in Tiberias by Galilee, and one of the girls describing it as like living in a hairdryer. There was just a constant wind. It must have been about a 20, maybe to 25 mile an hour wind, really quite strong wind, and so warm, not gusting at all, but it was like living in a hairdryer. And I can recall driving once from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in a snowstorm, that was... again, something which has contributed to my feeling that it's a land of contrasts. The weather can change quite a lot. This might seem like nothing to do with weather, but it's from the book of Jonah. And right at the beginning, Jonah chapter 1, you can read that Jonah went down to Joppa, otherwise known as Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv. You can walk there from Tel Aviv. And he found a ship. And the reason he went there was to flee from the Lord. And we read that such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. And of all the places I've ever been and the storms that I've seen, the biggest electrical storm that I've ever seen was looking out over the Mediterranean from a restaurant in Joppa. So I have those verses from the book of Jonah mean something to me. The biggest electrical storm I ever saw. It didn't actually rain where we were, but looking out over the Mediterranean, it was quite a serious storm. In terms of contrasts, here's a picture of something known as the Sabra, or the prickly pear, and that's a classification of the native-born Jew. They tend to describe themselves or be described as Sabras. Why? Well, it's hard and prickly on the outside. And my memory of Israel, one of my earliest memories, is of seeing soldiers carrying guns. It wasn't something that I was used to the first time that I went there, and it's a little bit disconcerting. It's not a problem, it's not dangerous, it's just what they do. They're on and off duty quite a lot, and you'll see them hopping on buses, and we even gave one a ride on our tour coach, and this was a she, and she jumped on with her machine gun. So... the Sabra, hard and prickly on the outside. And I can recall two or three times ago when I was there, I needed to exchange some money for some shekels, and I walked around Tel Aviv. I looked at the currency exchange rate. And if you look in some of these shops that exchange currency, you've got a board with all the different currencies and what the rates actually are. So I took a little note of these over a period of a few minutes as I walked around. And I came to a shop, and the board wasn't working. And so I went into the place and I said, what's your exchange rate for pounds or dollars? I can't remember what it was. I said, your board isn't working. And the fella looked at me and on initial chats to the Israelis, I find them almost Asperger's or autistic-like, very objective. And he looked at me with a straight face and he said, the board is working absolutely fine. I just haven't turned it on. Said in a, would you want to fight about it, sort of attitude. But soft on the inside, that's the Sabra. And I have found them to be, as I have worked with them, just like that, soft on the inside. And note that my name, Ken, means yes in Hebrew. As a description or a an indication of what they're like on the inside. I can recall once sitting in an Israeli canteen, and I had been told that the menu gave us a choice between chicken and fish. On that day, I fancied fish. And this is from over 30 years ago, and I can recall the conversation fairly accurately even now. And I was talking about the meaning of words. I like words and what they mean. And I said to my colleagues, "What's fish?" In other words, what's the word for fish? And my colleague said, "Fish is dag in Hebrew." At which time, the waiter, while this conversation was going on, brought the choice of chicken and fish to the table so that she could see what it was like. And I turned to the waiter and I inquired which was which. They were breaded, so you couldn't tell which one was which. So I said, "What's chicken?" My colleague, thinking that I was still talking to him, said, "Chicken's off." Because that is the Hebrew word for chicken. So I thought there was now no chicken. So I looked at my colleague who said, "Chicken's off," and I said, "Off?" The waiter thought that I was wanting chicken and said, "Ken." So, so I turned to him because he called my name and found that he was putting chicken on my plate because I said that was what I wanted. So I had two conversations on the go and they both failed dismally at the same time. So I gave up and a couple of other colleagues were watching this happening and just laughed. So they're normal people on the inside. As I've wandered around and observed things, one of the things that meant something to me was these words from Luke 10. A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. This is Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan. And the man fell among robbers. And Jesus chose Jerusalem to Jericho in his parable because if you travel that route, or the route that the traveller himself would have been taking all those years ago, you'll see how devoid of vegetation it is. There's no shade. It's very hot. And it's the worst place pretty well the whole of the country, if you're going from one town to another, that you could be set upon by robbers and beaten and left by the roadside. So that parable was Jerusalem to Jericho for a reason. Another thing I can recall on my first trip there, being in Bethany and looking out of the window, it wasn't this picture, but looking out of the window and seeing a shepherd just with a herd of sheep and goats passing by along the road. The words came to mind from Matthew 25 of when the Son of Man comes in his glory, he will separate the people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And you'll see that to this day, a shepherd with a flock or a herd of mixed of sheep and goats. It's just like it used to be. Once again, this isn't the specific picture that I'll talk to, but the words that came to mind when I saw a flock of sheep when I went there on a sort of little holiday with Angela 2 or 3 years ago were from John 10:27. "My sheep listen to my voice." And the reason these words came to my mind was that we were driving, I think it was from Bethlehem back to Jerusalem, and it was a four-lane road, two lanes on both sides, and the cars were whizzing by, and it wasn't an easy road to cross. And you know, you get some roads and you think, well, they're not too easy to cross, but I could do that fairly safely on my own. And then you think, well, if there was a group of people, that's a bit harder, because if there's a group of 3, 4, 5 of you, you have to say, look, this is a difficult road to cross. When I say go, we go. Okay, we can't dribble across here because somebody's going to get hurt. So quite a fast road this was. And there by the side of the road was a shepherd with about 40 sheep. And I can recall thinking, he was going to cross the road. And I can recall thinking, this is an accident waiting to happen. Now, clearly it wasn't, because this was something he did every day. He took his sheep from one side of the road to the other. And I recall saying to our guide about how difficult that would be with a bunch of people, let alone a bunch of sheep, you know, trying to get the sheep to follow you. And he said, well, the sheep wouldn't follow you because they don't know your voice. That's very important. The sheep know the voice of the shepherd. And Jesus said, "My sheep know my voice." Jerusalem, an absolutely beautiful city. Once again, a place of contrasts. I would say you go to Israel, if you haven't been, and if you do go, it's fine to go with a group. I've had the privilege of being able to take my time when I've been there 2 or 3 years ago with my wife and also on business. I've had the privilege of just being able to wander around and look at what's going on and listen to what's going on. Discovering the narrow streets is a fantastic thing to do. Just take your time, wander around by night, by day. One of the ways to meet the people and see what they're like is to try the restaurants. They're not too expensive. We had a couple of fabulous meals in Jerusalem, one in an Ethiopian, another in Armenian restaurant. And you get talking to the people who work there, and you come to understand something of the culture and the background. I don't know if it comes out in this photograph, and there are some folk who would say, well, it's conjecture, and I'm sure that's the case, but Golgotha, which was the place of the skull, the rock has been eroded over the last 2 millennia, but you might just here be able to see the nose and the eye sockets and a little bit of the mouth, and this is the rock that you can see from the Jerusalem bus station. You look over onto this piece of rock, which looks like a skull. And not far away from that is the current garden, is the garden tomb. Is this the garden tomb? Don't know. It's got a lot of the hallmarks of what the Bible describes as the garden tomb. And that's just near Golgotha. Nothing to do with Golgotha or the garden tomb biblically, but here's a picture of some taxi drivers, and I can recall myself driving to Jerusalem to go see the garden tomb again. I'd been there before, and I parked up, and I recall seeing a load of white Mercedes cars, taxis, all parked one beside the other just outside, I think it was the Damascus Gate, and I remember noting with some surprise and interest maybe, one of the taxi drivers relieving himself on the wheel of the taxi, and not the sort of thing that you would probably see in this country in the daylight. I have to say, my memory of that made me smile. The thing that actually made me smile was not the taxi driver doing what a man's got to do. It was that after he'd finished, he got in the taxi next to it and drove off. An unusual place. We very much enjoyed the Dead Sea. I'm an engineer, and the facts about the places that I'm going to see I find quite interesting. It's the lowest place on Earth, the lowest land that there is on Earth, 1,300 feet below sea level. It's warm all the time, warm to hot all the time. So you could go to Israel any time of the year that you like, and you'll get some warmth whatever time you go. It's shrinking, 34 miles by 11 miles. It used to be bigger than that. And the thing about the Dead Sea is it is so dense. It's got a lot of salt in it. And it's a whole lot more dense than ordinary seawater. And the consequence of that is that you can... and it's very pretty. There's a picture of some blossom there just looking down onto the Dead Sea. The young lady there is just about to go for a swim in it. And you can maybe just about notice a copy of a newspaper. You have to take a newspaper to the Dead Sea. You have to do that because when you get in, you've got to be photographed reading it. And you can see, and this is a copy of the Times so that people can see it's an authentic picture. You can see how much of the body can be supported by the density of the very saline water. When you're down by the Dead Sea, and you can do all this in one day, you can see Qumran, which is the place where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, and you can see something of the scrolls in Jerusalem, in a building built for that purpose so that you can see them. This is where a shepherd boy tossed a stone into a cave and heard a funny sound, and it was actually a clay jar smashing as a result of the stone that he'd thrown in. So he went in to investigate and found in the jars that there were a lot of scrolls. Those scrolls, I think, went through a number of sort of boot sales and finally got tracked down, and now they're in the hands of the historians and the academics who understand them and can preserve them down by the Dead Sea. And another thing that meant a lot to me was Masada. Sometimes you'll see it spelt with one S, sometimes two, built in about 30 BC, and taken over by almost 1,000 Jewish extremists in 68 AD. and they hold up there for about 4 years until they were besieged by the Romans in 72 AD and overrun a year later. And Richard showed you a picture of the siege ramp that the Romans built, and those 960 all committed suicide. They had 10 of them designated to kill all the others, which they did, so that when the Romans broke in eventually, they found absolute silence. Those 10 killed the others, and then one of those 10 killed the other 9 and then died on his own sword. There were, in fact, 2 ladies and 5 children who secreted themselves. They hid themselves in a room. So, in fact, they weren't all dead. And it used to be, and I don't know if it still is, but the Israeli soldiers would go up to Masada to take their oath. And it's a bit like the Alamo for the Americans. Remember the Alamo. And they take their oath up there that there won't be another Masada. So my view is it's great to go on a tour with a group of folks and you see lots of things and you see them quickly and you get a lot of information. That's fantastic. But from my point of view, what's meant a lot to me is just taking my time, and which I appreciate you may not necessarily have a lot of. And I would say just remember to take some time to stop and smell the roses along the way. And for those of you who are horticulturalists or botanists, we know that maybe the Rose of Sharon wasn't hibiscus, it was perhaps a crocus, but there we go. For artistic purposes, take your time to smell the roses along the way. Thank you.
Ken, thank you very much indeed. You can tell by looking at watches or the clock on the back wall that I lost control of the time before we even started. I'm hoping that you've had 4 talks that have been very different. Our objective was to stimulate your interest for those that hadn't been, and to bring you alongside people that had been, so that you feel that you can question them at any time in any of the services or any of our community activities and find out more, because clearly we feel that everyone should go at least once. In theory, we could have a question and answer session now, but we've run out of time, and so unless you protest violently, we'll close it here. I'd like to give thanks for the 4 speakers. They've put in a colossal amount of work, and they're not at all rehearsed. And I would like to also thank Mike and his 4 guys for producing the breakfast. And he is an unsung hero today because the oven decided to die on us halfway through. So the fact you got anything warm at all is divine. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you. Thank you.